Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us here in the Treehouse. Before we start our discussion of this week's entry into the Positive Masculinity playlist, I wanted to tell you to check out the show notes for the list of sources we use in this episode, as well as a list of content warnings. If you'd like to connect with us or share ideas for future episodes, find us on Instagram and Facebook at A Safe Place for Boys, or email us at safeplaceforboys@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening, and enjoy the show.
There's a whole, like, reading of the fluids of Phoebus in this. Like, I could write something for a literary journal right now, just all about Phoebus and his fluids in this.
Ew.
I'm telling you, the wind in his wound thing is, like, wicked.
It's very Christian, I'll tell you that.
Welcome to A Safe Place for Boys, compassionate conversations about masculinity in media. I'm Kelsey Sykes, and with me once again this week is my king of fools, Dr. Spencer Don Bennington, PhD. Spencer, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, because honestly, I thought I was going to come into this at the level of bellboy, but I got a promotion to king of fools, so yeah. I'm feeling pretty stoked about that. I get to rule the drunken bacchanalia for the next year, right? That's what I get to do? Sweet.
Yeah, and that's great.
Don't even have the ugliest face in Paris.
Well,
hey,
did we ask? No, you don't. You don't, and it's a mean distinction to make. And on that note, Spencer, what are we talking about this week?
Oh boy, we have the pleasure of discussing one of the most horrible Disney films. No, one of the most horrific. It's scary. It's awful. It's cringy. It's weird. Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Notre Dame.
Yes, the Disney 1996 film, animated.
Correct. Yes, we are talking about... There have been many adaptations of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, actually, but we are specifically talking about the 1996 Disney animated musical, which is, of course, based on an 1831 novel by Victor Hugo.
Loosely.
Yeah, but when we say loosely, boy, do we mean loosely. And speaking of, before we begin, I do want to just kind of get this out of the way. So in this musical adaptation of an 1831 novel, shockingly, there is some terminology used throughout, and in fact in the very title, that is not currently considered particularly respectful. So throughout our discussion, we are going to be using the terms either Roma or Romani to describe groups and characters, such as Esmeralda, instead of the terminology that is used in the movie. And I will put some resources in the show notes about sort of the history of the Romani people and why the G word is considered to be hurtful and a slur. But for now, it's enough to say that if people ask you not to use a particular word to describe them, you shouldn't. And Romani people have asked people not to use that word, so we're not going to.
That word is featured heavily
in
the film.
Yes, yes.
And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. We're still waiting for that Blu-ray slurless... Anyway.
Oh, boy. And actually, also, despite the title of the movie, we're going to try to avoid referring to a person as a hunchback, because that is dehumanizing and not medically accurate either. There are specific names for disorders that cause spinal deformations, so we can use those if we need to.
I think what Kelsey's getting at is there's a lot of really bad parts of this movie. There's a lot, and like, we're not going to sit here and say that there aren't.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that would not fly today. And yet, we're talking about it anyway, because it's got some interesting things to say, which I dare say you won't find in many other, if any other, Disney movies. And so it's worth talking about, but I mean, Kelsey will tell you, I've been frustrated by it.
Yeah.
Our pre-show meeting was a freaking disaster, because I'm torn so much by this thing, and I think, if anything, Kelsey proved to me that means it's worth talking about.
Yeah, as always, we're not saying that this... Anything that we recommend here is a perfect piece of media with no faults, and that you should consume it non-critically. We consume everything critically. That's what we do here.
It's exhausting.
And yet you agreed to it. Okay, so we'll do kind of a quick plot rundown. So this story follows a character named Quasimodo, who is a young man with a condition called kyphosis, which is a group term for a number of disorders that cause curving or bending of the spine, along with, you know, a constellation of other disabilities. And our boy Quasimodo lives under the patronage, quote unquote, of a man named Judge Claude Frollo. He is a magistrate in the city of Paris, France, in some unspecified year in the Middle Ages, presumably. And Quasimodo works in the bell tower of the Notre Dame Cathedral. He rings the bells. The character of Quasimodo could very well have been based on a real person.
Oh, dang.
So there is some evidence. There are some memoirs of a man named Henry Sibson, who was a 19th century sculptor. He was a contemporary of Victor Hugo, and he actually worked on the Notre Dame Cathedral. And he described in some of his diaries a stonemason who had this, you know, condition. His name was, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this right, Trajan?
Okay, hold on. I'm going to set you up for this because, you see, Kelsey lived in France.
I did not. She went to France for 2 weeks.
She lived in France. Okay. Not. And she studied French for years in high school. And now she's going to tell us the name of this historical French man whose name is
Trajan. I'm sorry.
Trajan.
It's spelled T-R-A-J-A-N. Anyway, there are some writings from contemporaries of Victor Hugo's describing a person who roughly meets Quasimodo's description, who really did work at the cathedral at this time. So it's entirely possible, for better or worse, that Victor Hugo heard about this man or met this man and was like, I have to write about you.
Wait, he was a stonemason, this dude, this potentially Trajan?
Yeah.
Not a bell ringer?
No, not a bell ringer. He comes to live in the cathedral as a baby because his parents, who, at least in the film adaptation, are Romani people who are trying to immigrate into Paris, and they get caught by Judge Frollo, who his whole thing is genocide. So he arrests Quasimodo's father and accuses, he sees that the mother has like this bundle in her arms and says that must be stolen goods. You've got to chase her down and take them from her. And she runs to the cathedral where Frollo, I guess his horse, like, kicks her down some stairs and she
Frollo kicks her.
Oh, does he?
Frollo kicks her. Yeah, he kicks her in the face. She backspills. I mean, just like crackety crack down the stairs, dead immediately. Even 8-year-old me would have been like, that lady's dead.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no, they confirm.
Yeah.
This is the first 5 minutes of the movie, by the way. Just a kid's movie.
It's not a kid's movie!
It was marketed towards kids. We'll talk about that later. And so he picks up the bundle and discovers that it is, in fact, a baby. And
Sort of.
Well, yes, he is disturbed by the appearance of the child and thinks that it's a monster and tries to drop it down a well until the archdeacon runs out of the church and is like, what are you? You have murdered a woman and now you're going to drop a baby down a well? Like, no, dude. No, you don't do that. The God and all these creepy statues on the outside of this cathedral are going to judge you forever. And for apparently the first time in his whole life, Frollo has a sort of attack of conscience and decides not to murder the baby. And it's
pretty much up in the air, too. It's like, is he? Like, is he gonna? He's not. He's resisting it. He's not about it. Like,
yeah, the archdeacon is like, no, if you want to make up for this horrible thing you've done, you need to raise this child, which I will say, I don't know that it's great advice to be like, did you just murder this child's mother? You should take in the child. I bet you'll do a great job of raising this child.
Do you have a personal vendetta against people of this race? Oh, you should be the father, the sole caretaker of a person of this race. You don't even see this as a human. Yeah, you should definitely just take this thing and own it.
Yeah. So we're all making bad choices in the first 5 minutes of this movie. And Frollo basically immediately then pawns the baby off on the archdeacon and says, keep it in the cathedral somewhere. Go shut him up in the bell tower. Just stick him up in the bell tower. He'll be fine. And so Quasimodo grows up never leaving the cathedral. He grows up just like ringing the bells every day.
This dude, our boy, is just like swinging George of the Jungle style.
Full body, just like dong. It turns out that it's a pretty good workout to ring bells the size of a Cadillac every day of your life for 20 straight years. That will come in handy for Quasimodo later. But anyway, he hangs out with sentient gargoyles, question mark?
Sure.
and he makes little, like, D&D-style minis of all the townspeople that he can see from up above. And it is very talented as an artist, apparently. But all Quasimodo wants his whole life is to go outside, like a normal person. But Frollo raised him with this just constant stream of insults and fear-mongering about the outside world. He's constantly saying that Quasimodo is this horrible, hideous monster, and nobody but Frollo will ever love him. And it's just like literal textbook child abuse.
Fully brainwashes him.
Yeah. And Quasimodo kind of buys into a lot of this, as one would when it's the only thing you hear for 20 straight years is sure. that you're terrible and unlovable.
Yeah.
But he's remarkably positive in the face of this treatment.
Almost unbelievably so.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, I we were talking about this before. I've met people that have come out the other end of an abuse dynamic this way, where it's like, they're so starved for attention and love that they end up being this level of positive, but mm-hmm. it's hard to believe. It's hard to believe,
yeah.
But he's, you know, he's a beautiful, beautiful boy.
And he does in fact manage to leave the tower. There's a peasant festival in the like square below Notre Dame. And he wants to go cause they have a parade and it's fun. So Quasimodo, does go down to this festival and through a sort of series of like weird, unlikely bumbles end up getting crowned the King of Fools. They're having a competition at this parade, this festival, to see like who can be the ugliest person in all of Paris, because it's topsy-turvy, that's the song. So everything is like, instead of crowning the most handsome man the prince, they find the ugliest, you know. And like for a half a second, Quasimodo's having a great day. And then the guards, these like soldiers that roam around Paris and are like essentially acting as the police, just start throwing tomatoes at him. And the townspeople of Paris, as depicted in this movie, are just looking for an excuse to devolve into rabid violence at any moment. And so, like, a police officer throws a tomato at this man, and the next thing that happens is this guy in the crowd is like, great, and throws a noose on him. Like,
yeah.
Sir, you have escalated to an outrageous degree.
And then it goes from one guy with a noose to just apparently 10 people in the crowd had nooses ready to throw.
Yeah, just a bunch of ropes start flying. He gets, like, tied down to this little pedestal, and Esmeralda, who feels bad already because she kind of thought he was wearing a mask and was like, you should totally join the contest, and then immediately realizes her mistake when she's like, oh shoot, that's what he actually looks like.
Also though, like, that's a believable mistake to make. Everyone's, it's a masquerade. Come on.
Yeah, she's like, hey, let's not like kill this poor boy that hasn't done anything wrong. And so she, you know, she cuts all of the ropes off of him, and Frollo, who's been watching this whole thing and was the one who told Quasimodo, don't go down to that festival, terrible things are going to happen to you, is just sort of smugly sitting there watching it all happen.
Well, and also commands Esmeralda to not free him.
Yeah.
And she defies him,
yes,
by cutting those ropes, which sets the rest of the plot into motion.
Yeah, so that Frollo decides, like, okay, we need to arrest this woman. He already, does he like her or dislike her? That's the question. But he is already not happy with her because she did, like, a sexy dance in public and, like, put a scarf on him and made him feel emotions. And
that's
so
it. Made him feel a thing,
yeah,
that he doesn't understand.
So he already is mad at her, and then she cuts down Quasimodo, and so he's like, arrest her. And this is where Captain Phoebus, who is a member of Frollo's guard, he is a soldier who has come back from the wars. The Crusades, maybe?
Wars.
Yeah, whichever wars he has just come back from, and he is Mr. like a noble shining knight, and he doesn't like bullies, and so he doesn't feel great about being told to chase down Esmeralda. And so he sort of suggests that she run into the cathedral and claim sanctuary, which means that as long as she is inside of the church, she cannot be arrested, which I don't know if that's has ever been or is currently a legal policy, but when I was little, I definitely thought if you were inside a church, you couldn't get arrested.
I also thought that.
So Esmeralda and Captain Phoebus have this, like, mildly sexy combative exchange where he is just trying to be like, I am not trying to hurt you. I know I look like I'm working for Frollo, but, like, I don't think you should be arrested. You should stay in the cathedral and stay safe. And, like, I'm trying to help you. So Esmeralda stays in the church for a little while. She sees Quasimodo. She goes up. She sees all his cool art projects and so forth. And he helps her escape from the roof of the building because the bottom of the church is surrounded by soldiers, but he kind of knows how to do parkour. So
George of the parkour, throw in Esmeralda.
Yeah, just like really doing some impressive feats of strength, gets her out of the building. And so in exchange, she gives him this like pendant that has a map to a place called the Court of Miracles, which is sort of where the safe haven for the Romani people in the city of Paris. And meanwhile, back at the Palace of Justice or whatever,
meanwhile, at the Palace of Justice,
Frollo gets a boner and has a goddamn meltdown about it.
He really does. This is actually shot for shot. Kelsey's not minimizing, exaggerating. That is the script of the film. Those are the stage actions.
That happens to him is, he experiences a sexual attraction and just has a full, like, hallucinatory, like, Latinate chanting, throwing things into the fire, just like praying to the Virgin Mary, who I can only assume does not want to hear from him. And when he finds out that Esmeralda has escaped from the cathedral, he decides that he is going to burn the city to the ground in order to find her, because he has decided that either she will not, like, just have sex with him, I guess, or she has to die. That's the result of his sort of epiphany with his fireplace, is this woman is evil, and either she can use her evil to sexually service me, or she has to die. Those are the only two options.
Or, like, this woman, like, she cannot be free. She cannot be allowed to choose sexuality wantonly by herself. I must control her. If she submits to me, then it's not a bad thing she's doing anymore. She's like within the rules that I understand and can control. But like to give someone else control, like that's this big scary.
Yeah.
Give a woman.
Yeah. Well, and a woman who in many ways does not fit in with any of the rules of society as he understands them. She is, you know, not a person he approves of in general. So to be a person he doesn't approve of and to make sexual decisions for yourself is unacceptable to him. And so he just starts burning buildings down. And
with people in them.
Yeah, with people in them.
Because he sucks.
Yeah.
Wait, he's the worst.
Yeah.
Hate him.
And so Captain Phoebus is all like, hey, let's not burn this innocent family alive for no reason. And he, like, kicks down the door and gets the family out of the burning building. And Frollo is like,
ha, gotcha. Yeah, I'm going to cut your head off now.
Yeah, this was a test. Yeah. And is just like, we're going to kill you now. So Phoebus is on the run. He steals Frollo's horse. He gets shot by an arrow, falls off a bridge into the river, where Esmeralda fishes him out and takes him back to Notre Dame for safekeeping, because the only safe place she knows is Notre Dame, because she trusts Quasimodo to keep him safe.
He's baptized by the rebellious fire. He's cleansed in the dirty water. And then he's sanctified in the sanctuary.
That's a religious experience if I've ever heard it. He has wine dumped in his arrow wound, which is probably not that good. Don't put wine in. I know you think alcohol can clean a wound. Don't use wine.
Wow, man, this movie is so weird.
And so meanwhile, back at the ranch, the gargoyles are trying to convince Quasimodo that he should tell Esmeralda that he likes her. But in my notes, I wrote, Quasimodo is good at reading the room. What Quasimodo is actually good at is standing like 2 feet away as Esmeralda and Phoebus just like really make out for a while.
Extremely uncomfortable scene. This is Quasimodo's bed in a presumed very small cramped attic space where he lives by himself. He doesn't really have anywhere else to go.
Yeah.
He has to be there, and he's, like, giving his bed up to this dude who is wounded really badly, and then they... Come on,
just make out right in front of him.
And then he weeps!
Yeah, he just cries. It's so sad. But Frollo has kind of followed them back to the church. Frollo is putting together that maybe Quasimodo is the person who helped Esmeralda escape in the first place. And so Esmeralda has to run really fast, and Quasimodo just kicks Phoebus's like unconscious body under his table. And has this very tense interaction with Frollo, where Frollo is just immediately like, I know you're the one who helped her. I know you're still helping her. I'm going to attack the Court of Miracles tonight with 1,000 men. And his ploy does unfortunately work.
Yeah, he's really smart, actually.
Because Phoebus is like, oh no, we have to go now. And Quasimodo has like half a second where he's like, no, she likes you better than me. I'm not going to help you. And then, like, literally 2 seconds later is like, no, no, he is just going to go and kill her. I have to help Phoebus. And just like that, they are a contentious team, but a team nonetheless. So they go and find the Court of Miracles, and they want to try to warn Esmeralda and the others that Frollo is coming. And Clopin, who is the jester, who is also kind of the narrator of the story, is like, haha, you found us, you clever boys. We're going to kill you now. Because that is how they protect their secrets, which is understandable given how many people are trying to kill them. But Esmeralda is like, no, they're friends. And it's a very nice moment until it turns out that Frollo just followed them there, because that was his plan the whole time, was like, oh, they're going to go try to warn her and I'll just follow them and then I'll know where she is. So he arrests everyone who is there in the Court of Miracles, including Phoebus, and he takes Quasimodo back to the cathedral and, like, ties him up like Samson. He's, like, strung up with chains between these two pillars in the church, and he's like, we're gonna have a witch burning. So Frollo tries one last time as Esmeralda is tied to a stake. He's basically like, you wanna come fuck this? And she's like, I don't. And so he's like, okay, I'll kill you then, and sets her on fire. Quasimodo sees this happening and, like, again, like Samson, just pulls these pillars down because he is so strong, is the thing about Quasimodo, is he is a beefcake. He's huge. He's so strong. So he just pulls these pillars down, does his parkour, goes down, gets her off the stake, takes her back up to the cathedral. He's like, haha, I have saved her. And, you know, they start this sort of assault on the church to try to get her back out. And in all the chaos, like, Phoebus gets out and he sort of yells at the crowd like, oh, Frollo has been oppressing us and our communities and we're not going to take it anymore. And the crowd, again, Paris, always ready to throw down at any moment, will attack any target that in the least provocation. So the crowd just turns against the soldiers.
Vive la revolution!
Yeah. They love it. They love to fight. And in the church, like, they have a giant cauldron of just, like, molten metal or something.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about. What are they forging in there?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Bells?
Yeah.
They forged new bells there?
That might be what it's supposed to be for, but
that actually
this very visually arresting scene where, like, the whole ground is, like, on fire, and then they pour this, like, essentially lava down through, I guess, the gutters of the building, and it's, like, pouring out of the mouths of the gargoyles, so the whole church has, like, fire pouring out of it. And it's very cool looking. And Frollo manages to get inside, and he climbs up the bell tower, and he finds Quasimodo upset, because it kind of looks like Esmeralda's dead, because she did inhale a lot of smoke. And he tries to kill Quasimodo, but joke's on him. Quasimodo, again, very, very, very strong, overpowers him pretty quickly. They are kind of fighting on the roof. And Frollo ends up, you know, he has this moment where he's like, and they shall smite the wicked. And then immediately the like gargoyle thing he's standing on crumbles and he falls into the lava and dies. Yeah. And that is the end of this G-rated kids movie. The last scene is just like the crowd being like, Quasimodo's a hero, and this little girl comes up and like gives him a hug, and it's very sweet. I guess. But boy, you sure did just watch a man fall into some lava and die.
Not only a man, it was you know, Quasimodo slapping his Sifu, killing his master, like saying bye bye daddy. I don't know, this movie is messed up, man. Like, what are we going to talk about? Like,
well, I mean, I...
Why? Yeah, my first question... Hi, Kelsey. My first question for you is, why are we talking about this fucked up movie this week?
Because I'm obsessed with it. That's why. So you did not watch this movie as a kid, correct?
Hell no. No. No, this one wasn't on my radar. I don't know how I missed it, but
yeah,
maybe my parents knew. They heard
through the grapevine that maybe this one wasn't for the 7-year-olds in your life.
I mean, I really don't know. I'm glad I missed it. It's messed up, man. I feel sort of traumatized today from watching it last night. I'm 32 years old, Kelsey.
Well, I watched this movie all the time.
Explains a lot.
This was one of my most watched movies. The only one I remember watching more was the live-action Cinderella that had Brandy and Whitney Houston in it. And fun fact, also featured Jason Alexander as, this is my theory, he was the like sassy, queer-coded best friend in the 90s before it was acceptable to be like, this is my sassy gay best friend, which is kind of no longer acceptable to do. But before all of that, we had Jason Alexander. And the weird thing is, I was like, there were other Disney movies. I was so scared of Beauty and the Beast when I was little. I wouldn't watch Beauty and the Beast because I thought the Beast was so scary, which in retrospect is also correct. But for some reason, this movie didn't scare me at all.
The Beast I always identified with way more. Like, that's a much more understandable version of masculinity to me than Rollo. And I'm just going to keep calling him that Rollo. Because I can only assume that Frollo just stands for the worst inverted, unholy version of one of my favorite candies. He's the opposite of sweet.
Yeah, he is. But none of that fazed me as a kid. I just have memories of thinking this movie was really pretty.
It is pretty.
There's, you know, they have all the stained glass windows and like that he has up in the tower. He's got all these like stained glass pieces hanging from the ceiling and he's got all his little like, again, just like D&D sets of like buildings he's built and little characters he's created. And I just remember thinking like, oh, it's so pretty.
It's a visually interesting movie. And I think it does a lot of good visual storytelling.
All of that comes together to create a very, very strange choice for a Disney movie during the era referred to as the Disney Renaissance. And I will link to this sort of oral history of this movie in the show notes as well, because it's buck wild. But basically, they were like, we're going to make this thing. There's no way Disney's going to go for it. They're going to give us all these notes of all this stuff we're going to have to change, and we'll deal with it then, I guess. But I want to try to make the draft of the thing I want to make. And in the marketing for this movie, they were like, we're going to put the gargoyles on a poster. We're going to put the words, join the party.
Oh, what?
And we are not going to tell anybody what this movie is about. And they got their G rating. So people rolled up in 1996 with their like 4-year-olds being like, oh, it'll be like the Little Mermaid.
Or the Lion King.
It's going to be like the Lion King. It'll be so cute. What?
The hell?
That was 1996. Can you imagine? You're like, we're going to take our kids to a fun musical. And then you're like, well, now we have to explain the sin of lust. Oh, boy.
Just last week, I had to tell my middle schooler what marijuana was when she glimpsed it at school. And now I have to talk about repression? God damn it, Disney!
Oh, yeah. So it's just write it in the list of things that could never be made nowadays. But I am glad it was, because I think this is a wild piece of media. It's deeply weird, and nothing like this will ever be made again. Not for a very long time. Certainly not for kids. And it is interesting as an adaptation as well. So, already weird to read a Victor Hugo novel and be like, how do I make this for the kids? So they had to change quite a bit about the source material in order to make it into something that was at all optimistic, because the original is just, it's just a gothic story. It is it's sad and dark and terrible from start to finish. And each of the characters changed to various extents from the original to the movie this movie adaptation, at least. There are others. The character who changes the least from the page to the screen is our favorite candy, Claude Frollo. So in the original book, he is, in fact, an archdeacon. He is a member of the clergy. Whereas in this version, in this version, they change him to a judge, mostly because they did not want to, like, take on the Catholic Church quite that directly in the way that the book does, which I I mean, I can't really blame them for, but it also makes for some weird, like, they don't specify, like, exactly what his role is in, like, the local government. So he just is, like, in charge of the, like, police sl/ the army. And, you know, he is punishing prisoners. And, you know, yeah, he just has a weird, nebulous amount of power.
He's a warden and also a commanding officer and a public figure. Yeah. It's almost like he occupies like two forms of government at all times in this movie. And that's important because his character is largely based in this belief that he's infallible. Like,
yeah,
he's the top dog, and so much so that he like retrofits dogma to conform to his worldview. It's very strange. He's beyond. Like, he is beyond.
He is definitely bending the rules of the world to work for him instead of the other way around. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to have any, like, superiors that he answers to. Mm-mm. He just kind of does whatever he wants whenever he wants. But he is supposedly a respectable public figure. And the thing that doesn't change from the book to the movie is that he is sexually obsessed with a woman who has no interest in him and also who belongs to an ethnic group that he is actively committing genocide against.
Yeah.
And those two things are kind of constantly reinforcing each other, where he already hates the Romani people for not being nice Catholic Europeans or whatever. And then that kind of fuels his sexual obsession with her because she's kind of exoticized in that way. And then the fact that he's exoticizing her makes him hate her and the rest of her people even more. And it's just this vicious cycle, where, you know, his personal faith has led him to believe that feeling attraction for another person is a sin. Thus, anything that he does to her as a result is justified because she has to be stopped because she's this evil, vicious force, etc., etc., etc.
It's also worth mentioning, he's not just, like, armchair genociding in the way bureaucrats of the past have been known to do. He's not just the man in the chair sort of giving the orders. We see him very actively participating in violent acts, murderous acts, because he is so self-righteous. And so when he sets his sights on Esmeralda, everything that you just mentioned, all those recursive participants of his various motivations fueling one another, is toward a personal and political violence, all in one. And he's totally down to go burn down some houses himself. He's batshit. Like, this guy sucks.
Yeah. And like many villains, he is obsessed with power above all else, beyond even just his, like, religious beliefs. We don't get a lot of specifics as to what exactly he believes, other than he is infallible and the Romani people are bad. Those are the two things he believes. And he sees everyone else as just sort of a pawn in that power structure. So at the very beginning, when he first takes Quasimodo in, the line that he says is, "And who knows, our Lord works in mysterious ways. Even this foul creature may yet prove one day to be of use to me." Mm-hmm. So that's how he sort of rationalizes his raising of Quasimodo, is like, this is a tool that if I shape it correctly, I could use someday for one of my personal gains.
Not even, like, because that line you just quoted says, at the end of the day, he ultimately believes our Lord serves him.
Yeah.
Frollo. Because he says, our Lord works in mysterious ways. Who knows? You may still be of use to me. He doesn't say, if I serve our Lord and do this thing. Mm-hmm. He says, I don't know what the Lord is going to do. He might make you useful for me, to me. Like, you know what I'm saying? So, like, that from jump, that's within that first couple scenes in the movie, right? Like, we see him from the beginning have this bass-ackwards idea that, like, when he needs to consult a higher power or an authority, he sings in the mirror. He talks to himself, and he like manipulates all. Scary.
He's a very frightening person, and it makes him particularly dangerous to someone like Esmeralda, who is already vulnerable and has so few places that she can look for help because she belongs to this minority ethnic group who is largely untrusted by most of the rest of the population. And she is exoticized and She just doesn't have anybody who could advocate for her, whereas Frollo is so thoroughly entrenched, it is implied, in both the religious infrastructure and the, like, legal infrastructure that he's essentially untouchable. Unless someone manages to convince him, as the Archdeacon manages to do very briefly, to, like, consider that he is being watched by a higher power. And every so often he remembers that. But it is only in moments, because of the horrible cocktail of ideas that he has been raised to believe, the only time that he becomes fearful of a higher power watching him is a moment when, like, he's not really actually doing anything wrong. Mm-hmm. This breakdown that he has in the middle of the story, where he is, like, getting himself worked up into a panic about the fact that he is experiencing sexual attraction, when, like, that's the one thing you've done in this story that is value neutral. Like, that's not... You have killed people, and you're worried that God cares that you want to have sex with someone? But that's his mentality. Well, like,
yeah, he's worried that all the other decisions in his life have been conscious and part of a plan that he can justify, something that we can sit here and debate and say, that's irrational, that's immoral, that's a dumb thing. Mm-hmm. How can he make himself believe that? But he did, and he did it in a premeditated way. Mm-hmm. What he's feeling now is what he would describe as a crime of passion, the fact that he is not in control of his emotional state, and the fear is that it will cause him to act illogically and irrationally, which means ungodly and unfit for his duties, which is to judge, presumably, to, you know, constantly be this cornerstone of rationality, because that became synonymous in Europe with godliness. Like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? So that's the thing that he finds to be sinful, but that idea is always wrapped up in the female, the exoticized other, the body. And it's a problem with a lot of Christian traditions, because it just stems back to this idea of control. Self-control is ultimately, you know, still this, like, thing that someone like Esmeralda is totally against. She's all about freedom, right? And so societies and institutions, everything that Frollo represents is an evil from her cultural vantage point.
Right.
And he thinks he's upholding virtue. And so the real sort of him losing his marbles is when he can't rationalize his behavior, because they're coming from a bodily place, they're coming from an emotional place, they're coming from a place that he doesn't have the tools to understand or deal with. And that's the great sort of flaw. That's what's missing in him that makes him a very scary person, but one that we can see being programmed in various points in history. We see this guy. Like, we know this guy.
Yeah. Well, and this is an idea that, I mean, it's not exclusive to Christianity, but it's something that in some of the research is referred to as the mind-body split, which is basically the notion that, like, your soul, your spiritual self, and your physical body are two entirely different entities. Your soul just happens to live inside of your body, but it is not your body, and your body is evil, mm-hmm. right? Your body is of the earth and not of heaven, so you are, you know, you're constantly fighting against your body in order for, you know, your soul to ascend to a higher level of spirituality or whatever. And one of the biggest threats to your spiritual sanctity is sexual desire, right? That's like something that so thoroughly exists under this theory. I disagree with this theory, mm-hmm. but the idea that that is a purely physical thing and not a mental or spiritual thing means that in you know, circles where this ideology is used, it's the worst thing that your body can do. It's the worst thing for you to act on outside of the very strict parameters that your religion has set up for you, which for most of these is, like, heterosexual monogamous marriage. And for the most part, like, an effort to create children and nothing else. And so you get a lot of these sort of horrible pseudo treatments where it's like, oh, you have a porn addiction and you have to like chastise yourself every time you think about masturbating. And like, it's a deeply unhealthy worldview. The most dangerous element that we see in Frollo, and whether this comes from the ideas of masculinity he was raised with, which are tied in with the ideas of Christianity he was raised with, etc., etc., you can't really tease those things apart. But what happened for him is that he thinks of, you know, his mind and body being separate, and he has this whole thing where to save people's souls, you have to punish their bodies. Mm. And if you already come from a mentality where it's like, well, women's bodies should just belong to me, like, that's property of the patriarchy, baby, that's mine. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, you're using your body by existing in public where I can see you and I can have feelings about you. You have done a thing to me that has put my soul in jeopardy. And therefore, you are inherently sinful. And in order to save your soul, I have to punish your body.
Yeah, what?
And you then have a right to do anything you want to other people's bodies in the service of saving their souls, because you, in your head and your feelings, can't deal with the attraction that you're feeling and can't think of a healthy way for that to manifest in your life. So you're just like, I have to kill her. And that's where Frollo gets to. He just gets to a point where he's like, she's so evil. She has to just go, or she has to fix what she has done to me.
This is a part where I, as a boy coming of age, fundamentally diverge from Frollo, because like, I remember watching like whatever Dan Brown,
Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, that one where there's that villain Silas that like flagellates himself.
Yeah, flogging himself.
You know what I mean? Like that, I understand. I'm like, okay. Like when I felt that way, I wanted to sort of punish myself because I felt like I was behaving inappropriately. Mm-hmm. But Frollo doesn't have that capacity. He cannot look at any of his actions and say, oh, I did a bad thing. Mm-hmm. In fact, the one time he does, he then says, I did a bad thing, but I do what God wants. And so the bad thing I did must have actually been a good thing because God works in mysterious ways. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's like, bro, what? So like when he goes and says, you know, he's going to burn down and hurt other people, and that's where I'm just like, I've definitely gotten angry. I've definitely gotten frustrated. I've definitely like behaved in ways that are irrational and emotional, but then I usually feel bad at myself. Like I don't, it's weird to me that someone then takes that energy, that emotional reaction out on someone else as punishment. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
He's well, a scary boy.
I suspect in real life, people who act out this kind of, you know, these sort of power fantasy versions of violence probably don't consciously know that that's what they're doing. But, you know, Frollo is meant to be a bit of a heavy-handed symbol in this story, I think. And so he is just verbalizing, like, this woman has made me feel things. She has to die to save her soul. Like, I don't think most people who enact violence on others have that explicit mentality, but who knows? Some of them probably have it implicitly.
Hey, do you think it was pretty heavy-handed when his eyes glowed red with fire as he quoted the Bible?
And he fell off a church to his death. It is not that, like, there are so many, like, individually evil people in the world who do things like this in real life. It's just that there are institutions, religious and otherwise, that do react in such a way to protect people rather than question their own assumptions. And so when you get an institution with power like this, I don't know that this movie comes down on the side of church good or church bad, but I do think it's arguing that when you use an institution to grant someone so much power and to not have anyone question them or have the power to stop them, then like it's absolute power, right? Mm-hmm. If power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's basically what happens to Frollo, is no one ever stops him. So he just keeps going bigger and bigger and bigger. He doesn't have any peers in this story.
And he doesn't view... He always talks about the townspeople as, like, gross, filthy
Everyone's
animal.
Beneath him. Yeah. Yeah, so we've kind of touched on parts of this already, but do you feel like... I mean, obviously, we talked about him being a symbol, but are there any parts of Frollo's character that you can see parallels to in the real world. Is there anything realistic about this character, or is he just pure hyperbole?
So I think the first 20 minutes of the film, when we're introduced to Frollo, and the song like likens him to the cold steel of Notre Dame, you know, and what we see is he's this kind of like slave catcher-esque figure, and he's like actively out there doing murders in sake of a genocide. Like, that to me feels, I hope, extremely unbelievable. But then later in the film, I mean, we just talked about power and institutional protections. Unfortunately, it reminds me that throughout history and today, there are people with so many more resources and protections than other people. And they have this kind of ideology or system that allows them to justify their own actions that actually, even just that cruel, violent version of him is not entirely unbelievable.
Right.
And that's scary enough. But I think the part more worth talking about that makes him a more well-rounded character is when we get to this fire song and his, you know, uncontrollable desires. And he is a depiction of someone who believes in this hierarchy of intelligence and baser instincts. So it's, you know, it's tough to talk about, but I think on some level, a lot of people out there just do, whether it be in puberty or in some of their first meaningful relationships, have to navigate this idea of what do I do when I don't feel totally in control, whether I'm extremely attracted or unattracted, maybe in situations where I want to be or don't want to be, or if my emotional state or sometimes my intellectual state, the things that I'm thinking about too much, my stress levels, if those things influence my feelings or romantic behaviors in ways that I don't feel totally in control of, it's a jarring experience because there's hormones at play. There's all sorts of like cultural ideas at play that might be stimulating some kind of anxiety. And there might be your own sort of mental stuff. I don't know. So I guess I'm here to say that like the part where he just freaks out and spills his beans and just cannot deal with the fact that not only does he like someone that doesn't like him back, right? That's like when we're kids and we're watching this and we're like, oh, unrequited love. No.
Right.
He does not feel love. He wants to own a person and control them because he is afraid of the manipulation and the havoc and the chaos they can sow if they are allowed to exist as a free person with their own, left to their own devices. You know, I remember being a teenager and I remember grappling with some of those feelings that I can look back now and say, I also at times, maybe briefly, maybe fleetingly, have wanted to control someone.
Right.
Because I'm afraid of letting them go and date Phoebus instead of me. For real. Like, well, yeah. Or, you know, what if I lose them forever? I'm afraid of the dynamic changing. I'm afraid. And so I act out from fear. And if I'm Frollo, I do it in violent anger. And I justify it somehow. If I'm me, real life me, you know, I just get sad and go listen to Evanescence in my room because I'm 12 or whatever, you know,
like
that was a long way of saying, I think there are parts that are believable about him, despite him being hyperbolic. But I think that like in this sort of period morality tale, he kind of has to be.
Yeah.
But that's the benefit of having Phoebus and Quasimodo.
Right.
And the Archdeacon and the Jester all there as like different parts of masculine identities, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of Phoebus, so Frollo is meant to be this sort of uber hyperbolic, like, this is the embodiment of what we might call the most extreme version of toxic masculinity, which is literally murderous. But the thing that this movie does, and it might be the only thing it does well, is present counterpoints to that point of view. So this is not a movie where it's like, if you're sad long enough, you'll get the girl, right? This is not a John Hughes movie. There are other ways of relating to women as directly modeled by pretty much all of the other men in the story. So Phoebus, in the movie, he is this, like, you know, almost too good to be true, like, very justice-minded. He is obviously attracted to Esmeralda. We see him kind of, like, semi-jokingly, like, leering at her while she's dancing and so forth. But he also, it is pretty clear, like, he thinks of her as a person. He does not behave all that aggressively towards her. He doesn't act aggressively towards Quasimodo, except when Quasimodo is kind of being aggro with him.
Being super aggro with them.
Yeah. I mean, there is some, like, sort of, like, latent sexism in the story itself, because it's like, well, there still has to be a guy there for her to pick, right? Like, you can't just have a story where two guys like this girl and she doesn't like either of them and she's just unattached, because, like, it's the thing of, like, if you're at a bar and some dude's being creepy to you, you have to be like, oh, my boyfriend will be here soon, because he won't respect you, but he'll respect another man, sort of thing. That's kind of, like, maybe under the surface a little bit, but he exists in this interesting space where at the beginning of the story, he has much more social power than both Quasimodo and Esmeralda. And by the end, he ends up relying on both of them literally to stay alive, and then kind of gets to pay them back by being genuinely heroic in these other ways. And he's sort of demonstrating that mutual respect for each of them. And that is sort of at the end of the day, what saves them all is not like divine intervention. It's just like, hey, if you're decent to people and you act with this sort of justice mindset, then, like, they will come and help you when you need it. And that is a far better basis for community than just like, I speak for God and I tell you what to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's just outlining the difference between a hierarchy that ultimately stops with one person interpreting whatever the universe, divine will, cosmology, as opposed to a distributed network of expertise, a community of practice. And it's, you know, we see Phoebus take charge when he needs to, when his expertise is called for, but he also yields when he realizes, like, well, I don't actually know how to get to the Court of Miracles.
Yeah.
You know, whereas Frollo will never do that. If he comes across a thing that he doesn't know how to solve, he's going to do it anyway because he's the highest authority and he has to. And so, yeah, I do love that about the three of these characters. And I kind of, Phoebus actually is perhaps my favorite part about this movie, the longer I think about it, because he shows up modeled. He's like on the same track as Frollo. He's supposed to be. He's born into money. He looks the part. He has, you know, he's a military hero. He's risen in the ranks. And presumably he answers to only Frollo in this movie.
Seems like it.
So he's like number two in the city when he shows up. And instead of going that route of seeking power for himself, there's something about him from the moment he shows up. And I you know, we joked about the wars earlier. But actually the fact that he's a battlefield veteran and a commanding officer makes it clear to me why he's so dramatically different from Frollo, a person who's never seen a battlefield. Like, this is a man who lives by himself in a literal ivory tower compared to a man who has had compatriots fight and die for a cause. And so, like, he understands in the same way that a lot of contemporary veterans understand, like, we all bleed red or whatever, like, whatever they say. You know what I mean? Like, so he comes back to this idea of, like, just blatant racism in a city. And he's like, what are you talking? They're just alive. Like, they're not, no one's like running at me with a lance out here. Like, what's your problem, bro? And I don't know. So the seed is already there for him to explore, you know, not a power grab, but a power distribution in a way that makes a city run. You know, it's like, it's just a different mindset from a battlefield. It's weird because Frollo is like treating it like a battle. All of his terms are militant. And Phoebus is like,
Well, yeah, it's this difference between like, oh, I'm fighting a spiritual battle versus like, no, you're not. Like, the stakes are so much lower for you because you're not facing consequences. Like, in a real combat scenario, if I make a bad call, I die or a bunch of people I care about die, whereas you don't seem to care about anyone to begin with. And so you're just out there just like throwing people into fires. It's just a totally different sense of stakes and of consequences
and of duty, because the, you know, Frollo thinks, oh, I serve the people by showing up and like, I'm a public figure for them, but I would never, I don't enjoy a second of it. You know, it's like, So you don't want to be, you don't want to help, you don't want to serve
them.
Yeah,
you don't care about
at all
any of these people.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like Phoebus because he starts there and then really has this believable growth path to ultimately become a refugee, a fugitive, a commoner. Mm-hmm. You know, he relinquishes and is stripped of his title and everything that comes with it to just be a person. You know, and that,
yeah,
that's pretty cool. That's embracing
humility in a moment where we talked earlier about the moment that he gets like shot off the horse and falls into the water. He is wearing like gold armor throughout the first half of the story. And he has a very clear, like, visual change from his saying, he makes a joke earlier about how his name means sun god. And, like, Esmeralda rolls her eyes at him because he's, like, trying to impress her by saying that. And then is immediately like, it's stupid and it's a stupid name. I don't know why. It's dumb. I shouldn't have done that. Like, he has a sense of humility throughout so that when he has that moment where he literally, like, falls from the sky in his golden armor and comes out of the water just in, like, an undershirt. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like a tragedy. For other male characters and other sort of works, that's a tragedy, right? But for him, it's very freeing. Because he can't, now he doesn't have to just follow Frollo's orders that are coming one way. He gets to be like, okay, Esmeralda and I are on equal terms. Quasimodo and I are on equal terms. Like, I still want to be heroic, but like, I need some help, guys. I'm wounded. I can only do so many things now.
Yeah.
It's very like Ian Malcolm getting his leg broken in Jurassic Park. I just thought of that comparison.
Yeah, no, it is, though. And it's great because Phoebus focuses on what he gains through that transformation, whereas the typical fall narrative of Lucifer or Prometheus, they are focused so much on what they've lost. And they craft immediately this vengeance plot assaulting heaven or attacking the gods, whatever. And what he focuses on is this like being reborn again into a state of agency.
Yeah.
Where you, like, you're not inherently good or bad at the end of this transformation. You just get to choose. You have this personal freedom.
Yeah.
And that's what Esmeralda represents. And that's ultimately what Quasimodo is questing for. He thinks he wants that external validation of the people, but he just wants the opportunity to get it, receive it, or reject it. And like previously, that's all been withheld for him.
Speaking of Quasimodo, that is the character who changes most dramatically from the book to the movie. So in the film, he, despite like being an abuse victim, is essentially an optimistic person. Like, even though he is scared of the outside world, he still kind of thinks it must be good out there and that like people must be fundamentally happy. And he has this hopefulness, that like just can't get beaten out of him. It is essential to who he is. And you wanted to talk about him, so let's talk about him. The way that this manifests beyond just like the songs he sings is the gargoyles.
Mm-hmm.
So in the movie, the gargoyles, they are his like hype men. They are Team Quasimodo. They are cheerleaders. They are always like, you should totally go out in the world. People are going to love you. You're great. You're so nice. You're so talented. You're so handsome. People are going to love you. Why wouldn't everybody love you?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, in addition to like that being basically the only child-centric piece of this whole movie, the only part of this movie I can imagine appealing to children are the gargoyles, because they're like goofy and silly, but they also are serving this vital function that anybody who is in an abusive situation like that really needs, which is just a counterpoint to, so like all Frollo does is come in and he's like, I've come to take care of you because I love you so much, and everyone else will hate you because you're a monster and you better not leave this and you better not do anything I don't want you to do ever because I love you so much. And the gargoyles are there like, no, he doesn't love you. He's wrong. The rest of the world is fine. You should go outside. People will love you.
Yeah.
And that being like the way out of the darkness for him, whether or not it is like realistic or, I mean, they're most likely a figment of his imagination, but that means that his voice inside his own head is just like essentially optimistic, which is the thing that saves him essentially.
Here's something worth noting. I think it's important that there are three gargoyles. They are distinctly different caricatures. There's a granny gargoyle. There's a Fraser uncle gargoyle. like, he's cultured and, like, doesn't understand commoner things.
And is very anxious.
Yes. And then there's the other version, the Jason Alexander, Dirty Uncle Gargoyle. They have this big song and dance, and they're really hyping Quasi up in the opening scene to go to the Festival of Fools, all in their own persuasive ways. Mm-hmm. They represent different rhetorics. And then, as he's about to go, Frollo comes up the stairs and says, "Who were you talking to, Quasi?" Mm-hmm. These pieces of stone, like, he makes mm-hmm. him say it, like, "These are made of stone and they cannot talk back to me." Like, so this is something, this is recurring behavior that other people have recognized. And again, it's a, like, a really important way of showing Frollo trying to exert his will and, like, tell Quasimodo how the world works.
And remove a positive outlet for him.
Yes.
Because that is an important function of control, is to make sure people don't have any other voice in their head but yours.
And again, I think it's important to mention that there are three, because I think this vibes with Quasimodo's character in that what he does for entertainment is pay attention to people from his window.
Yeah.
And so he seems to be the kind of kid who makes up stories and listens to bits of dialogue. He studies mm-hmm. people.
Right.
And so it's believable to me that he wouldn't just have a supportive imaginary friend or a gargoyle. He's got multiple people. He has perfect likenesses of all the townsfolk crafted, mm-hmm. right? So he has this complex understanding of how people operate. And so the idea of him imagining various counterpoints to the worldviews and perspectives mm-hmm. that are being offered by Frollo is believable.
Well, yeah. I mean, any time that you're making a piece of media for children, you can always tell, like, when a piece of media is addressing abuse, because there will be a certain contingent of parents who don't want their kids to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is saying to kids, like, you are allowed to listen to and trust the voice that is in your head. And if you have imaginary friends and they make you feel better, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily, it's not coming down heavy and being like, if your mom and dad say these things to you, you need to call the police. But right. it is saying, like, you are allowed to trust yourself and to think things different than your caregivers.
Right.
If they are saying things like this to you.
Sometimes these voices are so important that they can actually motivate you to be the change you want to see in the world, kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
They
are... They can empower you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I kept looking for it. That's the scene. I'm just like, okay, so the climax is when he listens to these good voices in him, the things that keep him optimistic and hopeful about the world,
yeah.
and rejects the voices that he knows are weakening him and divorcing him
yeah.
from community.
It's the gargoyle saying, "We're just made of stone."
Mm-hmm.
But we thought you were made of something tougher.
We're high all over the microphone.
Yeah. And it's interesting that he's sort of paralleled with Esmeralda throughout the movie. Because she is also fairly isolated. She has her community of other, like, Romani people that she sort of lives with and amongst, but, like, she is also coded as, like, his equal in many ways. Like, these two people are uniquely situated to understand each other, and, like, as soon as she understands anything about him, she is, like, his ally first and foremost, because they are both outcasts,
right.
to use the language of the movie. She, because she is of a different cultural background and ethnic group, Quasimodo, because he is visibly disabled. And so they are both pretty easy targets of abuse for someone like Frollo.
Mm-hmm.
And another good thing, I don't want to universally endorse this movie's depiction of either Romani culture or disabilities. There are plenty of discussions to be had about its treatment of those topics, but...
It's a Disney movie, y'all. It's a cartoon, okay? They didn't nail it, all right?
Yeah. But the movie makes it very clear that there is nothing functionally wrong with either of them. And neither mm-hmm. of them change over the course of the movie. And I made a comparison to John Hughes earlier. Like, Esmeralda does not get a makeover
mm-hmm.
and become quote-unquote respectable by the end of this movie. She doesn't apologize for any of her behavior, because none of her behavior has been bad. And Quasimodo does not have to do the gross thing where he, like, quote-unquote overcomes his disability and, you know, suddenly, like, everyone wants to marry him or whatever. Like, the change is internal in him sort of, like, loving and accepting himself and being brave. And that's the change. The change has nothing to do with his body because there's nothing wrong with his body.
Mm-mm. And the way they show us on screen is, you know, like I said, Esmeralda's clothing becomes less vibrant and it's more, it's a pattern with our boy Phoebus. Like, it's the white and gold. They look like a couple. And so it's like her relinquishing some amount of freedom by choice to participate in community. Quasimodo's visual thing is the same. It's when he joins their hands together and then clasps his hands over them. Like,
yeah.
He is saying, I'm willing to be part of a community instead of just live in my own imagined world in isolation. I don't want to be like Frollo. Like,
yeah.
And so, yeah, they don't change. They don't fundamentally change, but they grow. You know, yeah. Like,
Yeah. And it is, you know, about choosing your allies and forming a community that is based on respect and not relying on institutional definitions of who is acceptable and who is not.
Right. Or prescribed power dynamics or something, some nonsense. Yeah.
Throughout the whole movie, there is always a counterpoint thing happening with Frollo and Quasimodo. Every time one of them has a big song, the other one has a big song directly next to each other. Like, at the very beginning, there is the, you know, Frollo being like, the world is cruel, the world is wicked. And then Quasimodo immediately following it up with like, yeah, but what if it's cool, though?
Yeah.
But what if it's good? And then you have the song Heaven's Light, which is, you know, Quasimodo being like, oh, she was nice to me. Mm. Isn't that great? What, maybe there could be something more. Immediately followed by Hellfire, which is him being like, not if I kill her first. So they are always in conversation with one another. I think it is important that we see Quasimodo being visibly upset.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is not a story about, like, a perfect angel boy who is like, oh, I like you. Oh, you like someone else? That's wonderful. I'm so happy. Every option makes me equally happy. Like,
it does not.
He does have to struggle with that, like, I really like her, and she's the first person who's ever been nice to me, and she doesn't want me back, and, like, that does suck. That's not a good feeling.
There's a moment where Quasimodo is fighting Phoebus in Notre Dame, and the problem is he thinks not, oh, I'm mistrustful of this guy. I think he might actually be trying to hunt down Esmeralda on behalf of Frollo. Because that is what he says. He says, no, this is sanctuary. But the subtext is that he doesn't want Esmeralda to choose this shiny golden boy over him. And he has this moment where he could be like Frollo. He could just act out in violence and hurt Phoebus to prevent that. He could just throw him out of the bell tower if he wanted to.
Yeah.
But he doesn't. Because deep down, he's a nice guy. And so, like, not only does he struggle with the sadness of being rejected, maybe, or like feelings of rejection, but he also deals with this anger and potential for violence that he feels towards a guy that has nothing to do with it. Like, by being mad at Phoebus, you're denying any agency that Esmeralda has to choose a person or not a person, or just like to go live with her goat or whatever she wants to do. Like,
he is entitled to his hurt feelings, right? Like, and that is a big thing that sets Quasimodo apart from Frollo, is that he can have his feelings, and it first of all, doesn't frighten him to experience things in relation to other people, because, as you just said, like, he could be like, Phoebus is taking something from me, I'm going to hurt Phoebus, or Esmeralda is depriving me of something, I'm going to hurt Esmeralda, and that's Frollo's point of view. And while Quasimodo is, I think, justifiably sad, like, there is nothing to be gained by telling people they shouldn't be sad if someone that they like doesn't like them back. I don't think that is a healthy thing to believe or to tell someone. You're absolutely allowed to be sad.
And angry.
Right, and angry. And he does have this moment where, after he finds out that Frollo is heading for the Court of Miracles, where he has this sort of combination moment of helplessness and resentment towards Phoebus, that when Phoebus is like, we have to go and warn them, he's kind of like, no, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to do that. It's not going to work. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it with you,
right?
This person that she has chosen over me. And Phoebus is like, fine, I'll do it myself then. Okay,
right,
cool. Like, I thought you were a good guy. She trusted you, but whatever. And he has this, like, half a second where he's like, well, fine, go. I don't even care. I do care. I do care. I'm going. All right. I have the map. I need to help him. He's never going to find them without me.
That is the exact same scene when they're fighting in the stairwell, and Phoebus literally tells him, okay, like, I'll go, but if you see her, can you tell her for me that I'm trying to save her life? Like, and if you're the guy I think you are, you're going to help me? Like, yeah. You know what I mean? So the great thing about Quasimodo is that he listens to the logic of the world, and he's like, oh, fuck, yeah, if I were a good guy, I would help. You're right. All right, Phoebus, okay, God, I don't like you, but I'm going to help you if it's going to help her.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me, whereas Frollo bends that sort of logic to his own needs every time. He's so scary.
Yeah, and he comes around, ultimate Quasimodo comes around to this idea that, like, having this community of people who love me and who both in that climactic scene, like at one point Esmeralda is holding him as he's falling off the side of the tower and she's trying to pull him back up. And then when he does fall, like Phoebus extremely improbably catches him and pulls him back in and saves his life. And so it's like the visual imagery is very much that like these three people are now a community with each other. And like, maybe it is not like a romantic polycule, which, you know, maybe that would solve some of their problems. Maybe that wouldn't. But that they have functionally chosen each other in ways that matter much more at the end of the day than like, does this person want to bone me or not? Like, does this person see me as a person and think that my life is worth value and want me to have freedom and choices and love me regardless of whether or not I am serving them? And that is sort of the message at the end of the day, more so than like who got the girl, is like who now has like a family to turn to and people who will have their back. And when you've had nothing, which is what Quasimodo had before, he had whatever the opposite of community is, he now has that. And once you have that, then more opportunities open up to you. They'll make a sequel where you just, like, get a girlfriend, I guess, or whatever, if that's important to you. But it's better
but
to...
But we're not going
to
watch it.
Yeah, I'm not going to watch that one. Personally, you can watch it if you want to. It's on Disney+.
Well...
But yeah.
I think we did it then, huh?
Well, now I got my last question, which is on a scale of 1 to 10.
how many Rolos does this film earn?
Yeah. I know... Listen, this one is... it's a very complicated movie about a lot of complicated topics, and it's a weird little miracle that it got made, and it's maybe not for everyone, but on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you recommend this movie to the boys?
Oh, man. Nah. So, I think this is a movie worth intellectual analysis. I think that if you're an adult and you're looking for something to sink your teeth in, and I think the visuals in this do a really interesting job of storytelling. I think Phoebus as a character is interesting. Ultimately, though, I come down on this movie just being kind of like really heavy-handed and and violent in ways that are jarring to me, given the contrast of how beautiful some of the singing is and the visuals. The character Frollo is utterly frightening only because, like, he's so hyperbolic and yet somehow still very real. It's a movie that makes me uncomfortable, which means that I should be giving it a higher score because it means that it's got some art power to it. Like, you know, 20 however many years later, whatever, it still, like, made me feel some things. That said, it's not one of my favorites. So, like, if this score is me recommending it, I'm gonna give it, like, a 5 or a 6, and that's it. Because, like, JP hit a 7. This ain't a 7.
Oh, wow.
This ain't a 7 for me. I mean, and I know you got some nostalgia factor here, but I'm going to give it like a 5.5.
Okay. That's fair enough.
I'm going to give it a 5.5, roll those out the bag.
I wouldn't show it to your 6-year-old. There's an argument to be made for it being an instrumental part of my childhood, but I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing.
So. What would you give it? What score would you give it?
I mean, in terms of like entertainment value, if you want to sit down and watch something for fun, like probably like a 4 or a 5.
Yeah, because it's not fun, or it's not fun.
If you are a person who wants to find a way to talk to a young person in your life who is struggling maybe with some of the things that Quasimodo is struggling with, whether it is sort of an unhealthy familial relationship that they might need an outlet from, or, you know, just being a kid who likes someone who doesn't like them back. Mm-hmm. I think 6 or 7. I think it has some value as a tool to say, hey, if you don't want to be like this evil guy, mm-hmm. you're going to have to find a way to get rid of that fear of other people not liking you back and not being in control of other people's feelings. And we have to find some ways for you to, you know, respect other people's autonomy and start thinking of them as full people, because that's the only way you're going to have a healthy, normal relationship with a person. You can't go into the world of romance or even the world of friendship or anything else with this idea of, if people just do what I want them to do, everything will be fine.
Mm,
yeah. And I think that is a message that the patriarchy in particular sells to boys, which is just the ideal romantic life and the ideal family life is just everyone does what you want them to do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not realistic.
No, I can buy that as an educational tool. Like, until we find a better example and get to talk about, like,
yeah.
what's one that demonstrates, like, a healthy way of dealing with rejection and complex emotions surrounding repression, sexuality, and all that, then I'll say that, yeah, this is certainly one that gets that conversation going. You know,
yeah.
I don't think it gives answers. I don't think we have answers for you on any of that. But, like, if you're looking for an inroad to just talk to someone who's struggling with those...
You could do worse.
Yeah.
You can do worse.
Ring my bell.
All right, well, that's all for us this week. Join us next time here at A Safe Place for Boys for more compassionate conversations about masculinity in media. We will see you next time.
Thanks so much. Gotta pee.
Bye.